You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, August 28th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Are you guys all ready for Dragon Con?
Nope, not at all.
Yep.
Minimally.
Yeah. Hi.
Oh, hello.
Hey, what happened to your voice, Jay?
That's sorry.
Gilliam.
That's my son, Dylan, very excited about podcasts. Steve, I've been meaning to ask you, how is your new computer burning in? Is it still functioning?
Oh, yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, so it hasn't blown up, which is good. It's a good sign. Yeah,
this is the computer
that I built myself.
Still turns on.
So there's no subtle error in the motherboard that you're going to spend months troubleshooting?
No.
Like Bob's computer.
Oh, cool.
Bob.
I was thinking more like yours, Jay.
No, mine was a absolutely. Yeah, I did. I built the machine, and there was a I believe it was a grounding issue with the case. That is my final assumption.
But Steve had none of that.
No.
I had none of that, no. So what's interesting is that since I've been doing the exact same process for 12 years, I have a direct comparison that I could make over my various computers.
Oh, this is a cool story.
For example, I do multiband compression on the show when it's completely done, right? So I have a WAV file that's an hour and 20. Now, sometimes it goes a little bit longer, hour and 30 minutes. I use Adobe Audition multiband compressor. So it's basically the same software, same file, same exact process.
Apples to apples.
So it's apples to apples. So the computer that I was using when we first started podcasting 12 years ago, that process would take 12 to 15 minutes, right? I would literally go take a shower when the computer was doing that, when I was doing the show on Saturday morning. So I think this is the fourth computer I've used over the 12 years. The next computer was down to like 8 minutes. And then my most recent computer started out at around 4 minutes to do that process. But then when I upgraded the hard drives and the RAM, I got more RAM and I switched over the hard drives. So everything was 100% on solid state drive. It got down to about 2.5 minutes.
Wow.
Like maybe 2:30, which is really nice. You know, that's a lot. You know, waiting 15 minutes versus just a couple of minutes is a huge difference to the workflow, you know. So guess how long my current computer takes to do the same process?
A picosecond.
1 minute. 30 seconds.
50 seconds.
15 seconds.
Wow.
What? 15 minutes to 15 seconds.
That means Bob wins Price is Right rules.
That's right.
I went way over.
Yeah. Wow. So yeah, that's basically a 60-fold improvement in speed.
Wow, that's amazing.
So that Steve, did you push back from your desk when that happened and just like mutter like a holy shit right then?
Or did you say something's
amazing.
Wrong?
No, because you normally, like, you can tell just by how quick the bar is moving. You know, and again, normally I do something else, you know, and I didn't have to do something else. I could just literally watch it go for 15 seconds and it's done.
Wow.
So, yeah, over the years, I feel every ounce of speed in my computer doing the audio post-production because, you know, it's pretty resource heavy. Every upgrade I make, I notice a difference.
Nice.
Yeah. And it really
Let's get that down to 7 seconds really in helps. A couple of years.
Yeah. Well, now it's basically nothing really takes any time, you know? That's like the longest procedure I do. I do noise removal on the tracks. That may take 20 or 30 seconds. But still, it's no big deal. You know what I mean? Like, again, I used to like do it. It would take like 8 minutes. I would have to do something else, come back, you know, do the next track. Now I could just zip through all of them very, very quickly. So
science.
Yeah, really. It's fun to watch, you know, how computers have been, you know, they continue to progress, you know, they get so much faster. And it's not just I think the processors really haven't improved that much in the last 12 years. They have, obviously, but I think a lot of that is the solid state drives, faster RAM, faster motherboards. You know what I mean? It's all the other infrastructure as well. It's not just the processor.
Well, I don't agree. I mean, processors have evolved quite a bit. I think, you know, Steve, you have multiple processors now versus your computer 15 years ago. I mean, that's a huge increase in speed.
Yeah, but, although I don't know that the software is using multi-core processing to do that procedure, but
I'm saying the
processor has gotten faster, but I don't think that's you know all of that improvement in speed. I think it's because I've noticed significant improvements without upgrading my processor. Going to solid state drives is probably the next thing that that really improved the whole process. Yeah.
Steve, has the cost been pretty much the same throughout the generations of computers?
Yeah, that's the thing. All cost about the same. They have. Mm-hmm. The cost is, I think what I suspect is that the market kind of settled into this is how much a gaming computer costs, this is how much this kind of computer costs, you know what I mean? I think they certainly have come down at the low end, but they figured, yeah, people are they're willing to spend $3,000 on this kind of system. So that's what we're going to give them $3,000 worth of computer. You know what I mean? And that what you get for $3,000 gets more and more and more. But, you know, whenever I put together the kind of system I think I need to do what I do, it always seems to come in at the same price over the last 12 years, which is interesting.
Yeah. Computers didn't do what a lot of other electronics are doing where they're disposable. You know, I mean, even mm-hmm. like I was talking to Iran about how much it was going to cost him to replace the printer toner or the cartridge for his printer versus him buying a new one. And it wasn't that much more money to buy a brand new printer, which is very odd. You know, I had a similar thing even with my tractor for my lawn. My tractor had something major was going on with it, and I priced out a new tractor versus the repair, and the new tractor was only a few $100 more than the repair. Is that odd?
Yeah.
That is, for something, especially for an item like that. And Steve, you're lucky that you've essentially had this identical task for like 12, 13 years.
That I do every week.
Right.
That I've done 633 times. Right.
You're a case study, right. Basically.
That's a rare scenario, actually, I think.
Well, it doesn't matter to me like how, you know, futuristic or advanced the technology gets. I don't care. It's, you know, even if I live to be 150 years old and I had whatever the best computer was at the time, eventually, right around the 4-year mark, whatever I'm using is going to turn into a brick.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, sure.
It doesn't matter how much memory I have or how much RAM I have, the computer always just slows down and turns to mush towards the end of its life.
Well, it gets bogged down with so many things. It needs maintenance, it needs cleanup, it needs refreshing, all sorts of things.
I don't know. I don't agree with that. I mean, for my computers, what I've noticed is over especially the last 10 years is that computers are lasting longer and longer. Like in the 90s, when you got to the end of your computer's lifespan, it was worthless. Now, like, so my previous desktop, we've repurposed to our studio, and it's fine. It's great. It's more powerful than what we were using down there.
Did you reformat it from the...
I didn't have to because I had a relatively recent clean install of Windows on it. So I just cleaned up the hard drive a little bit, and it was...
I find that's what I need to get my old computer sort of back into usable shape.
If your computer's slowing down, probably the thing you need to do is a clean install of the operating system.
Hard drives
are easy to update, and I try to do them frequently anyway because I don't want to have all my stuff on a really old hard drive. So just I basically plan on turning over my hard drives. Plus, they're still on a pretty steep curve. The number of the gigabytes you get per dollar, I mean, it's amazing how much that's still improving.
I wonder if you would have had the same experience on the Mac platform. I mean, we're PC.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I'm Mac, but. I mean, and I edit on my MacBook Pro, but I don't really know how to compare.
Haven't been tracking it.
Yeah, and it's so not apples to apples, you know what I mean?
Ha
ha. And also, you know, it changes so much. Like even the way I do my podcast changes so much depending on if I have remote guests or if I do it in person. Like, and I use GarageBand and Audacity, and then sometimes I'll use other programs for post-processing. So it just really depends. And, you know, half the time I'm in an MP3, half the time I'm in a Wave, and lots of times that makes a big difference if the file is compressed. So, mm-hmm. But it does sound like Steve's computer is, like, way faster than even mine. And I'm on a brand new MacBook Pro.
Yeah, I mean, that was the whole point of me building my own computer was that I could get the most for the money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I got high-end everything, high-end motherboard, really good RAM.
For your specific tasks.
Yeah.
Sure.
And it's worth it because I do so much work on this computer. It's so much of my time. Again, every little bit helps the workflow. All right, guys, let's get started. Kara, you're going to start us off with what's the word?
Absolutely. So the word this week was actually recommended by a listener. His name is Peter Brown, and he said, I'd like to suggest the word liminal. I've come across it when reading archaeology books, in which context it seems to mean boundary places, such as land next to water. However, when I came to look it up, I first found psychological definitions. I suspect it's one of those words that have related but specialized meanings in different fields of study. And he spelled specialized with an S, which makes me suspect that he is Australian or British, even though he did not specify in the...
Or just dumb.
No. No. I've been reading a textbook. My stats textbook was written by a British person, and so it's like funny. You really start to notice the differences in spellings, like couleur and flavor. Yeah. And
theater.
Specialized, as opposed to specialized. Okay, yeah. So looking this up in Oxford and Merriam and a few other dictionaries, pretty similar definitions. The first one always having to do... Actually, no, the first one is different in both of these. So let's look at the British definition first. Oxford is kind of the standard for British dictionaries. The first definition there is relating to a transitional or initial stage of a process. And the second definition is occupying a position at or on both sides of a boundary or threshold. So that one is a little bit more similar to the archaeology definition that Peter gave. The first one is actually more similar to the psychological definition, which we'll get to in a second. On Merriam-Webster, there are some examples. So I think this might clarify a little more. First definition here is of relating to or situated at a sensory threshold, barely perceptible or capable of eliciting a response. So in, a lot of my background is in psychology and neuroscience. And so in perception and cognition psychology, we often call that a just noticeable difference. So it's either the first point when you can hear something or see something, or the first point in which two things that are different start to be perceived as different. Like just when is that tone slightly louder or slightly higher pitch? That's a just noticeable difference. So that would be a liminal threshold, or those would be liminal visual stimuli or auditory stimuli there. Second definition is of relating to or being an intermediate state, phase, or condition, aka the liminal state between life and death. So there is this theme of boundaries. There's this theme of threshold. So you can
see
how...
At the limit.
Yeah, at the limit. So you can see, and of course, that's where the word comes from. In a more kind of archaeological or maybe even concrete view of the term, you might actually see a physical boundary limit, right? The land to water, or the, what's it now called? It's not the KT boundary anymore. It's the KT...
PNG.
There you go. That would be liminal. In psychology, oftentimes we're talking about a threshold. So let's look at the etymology. This gets pretty interesting. We start with the word limen. Have you guys heard this word limen?
It's a lemon and a lime, right?
Right? Yeah, it should be. Limen is actually the noun for that psychological or physiological phenomenon that we were talking about. So it's that point at which it begins to be produced. And liminal is the adjective for that noun. So it would be a liminal threshold, but the limen is the actual physical noun. So we've all, of course, heard the word subliminal. Right? Below the threshold would be subliminal. At the threshold would be liminal. If you break down the word liminal and you look at its etymological roots, it was actually first used in around 1870 as a whole word, liminal. Before that, you could break it down into limen or limen, which of course comes from a Latin term, limitum, which is boundary, limit, or border. It's a boundary. It's a frontier. That makes sense, right? And then the interesting thing I found in looking at this is that the suffix ul, A-L, or al, actually has three different usages from an etymological perspective. So in this case, it's a suffix that just is added to nouns to form them into adjectives. Like limen goes to liminal. In that case, it just means of, like, related to, or pertaining to. That makes sense, right? We do that all the time with words.
Limen also comes from that song.
What song?
Limen the Coconut.
Oh, no. Such a good, such a dad joke, Steve. I love it.
Those are my specialty.
Yeah. So psychology and archaeology, but also any field, physics, geology, any field where there's a boundary, a threshold, or interestingly, a process. That's the one I think we often forget. So, and I love that it's so poetic, the liminal state between life and death, which may be an easy way to remember it.
Yeah, it's a cool word, I think, because it's very specific and technical, but it sounds almost a little archaic.
Yeah.
In a way.
And it also is one of those words where I think for a lot of people when they read it, they don't really know what it means. Like you don't have this, unless you've learned it as a vocabulary word, you don't have this gut understanding of it. Although we all know what subliminal means.
Yeah.
Which is so funny. And then it's the minute that you know that, you're like, oh yeah, well then of course liminal is actually perceptible. Subliminal is not. It's below the level of perception.
Below the threshold of perception.
Yeah.
All right, Evan, what was happening around 40 years ago?
Yeah, around 40 years ago. Well, if you've been paying attention, you know that the Voyager space exploration program got underway by launching both Voyagers 1 and 2 to search the outer solar system and beyond. 40 years ago, 40-year anniversary. So Voyager 2 was first launched on August 20th, 1977, and Voyager 1 followed on September 5th, 1977.
How come 2 was launched before 1?
That's a great question, Steve. In fact, they talk about that in the show itself, and I'll jump ahead a little bit, because they were saying about at the time, the press was having a difficult time with that. They said it to the press, it sort of made no sense that you would name it Voyager 2 and launch it first and have Voyager 1 go second and call that one. Voyager 1 was going at a faster speed. So on the way to Jupiter, it overtook 2 and actually reached Jupiter first.
Oh.
And they said that they were able to sort of avoid a media crisis at the time by explaining that to the media, who sort of in a way took exception.
Really? So Voyager 1 got to Jupiter first, and then Voyager 2 got to Jupiter. And so at that end, it made sense.
Yes,
and they figured it wouldn't worry about too much. Nobody would be as interested in the launch as the arrival.
Right. It's not about getting off there. It's about where you end up in the end. So,
what about reaching the edge of the solar system? Was that
yes? They talked about that. They obviously talked about that.
So one did it first, right? One hit it first.
Yeah.
One hit it first. Yeah. One's traveling faster than two.
So it's getting to everything first.
And what I saw was a great, beautifully made 2-hour documentary titled The Farthest. It's on PBS. It's broadcasting now. You can check your local listings to see it when it will rebroadcast in your area. And it's a look back on 40 years of the Voyager space exploration program, of course. A deep dive into the history of the program. It revisits the milestones achieved in planetary astronomy from interviews with the scientists who were part of the project. And of course, an update on where the Voyager crafts are today. I've been interested in Voyager since boyhood. I'm sure you guys all have as well. I was only 8 or 9 years old when it happened, so you guys were a little older than me. But did it not define the space program at the time? Certainly for science, adventure, all of that sort of wrapped into one. It captured all of our imagination.
Oh, it was huge. It was huge.
Well, yeah,
sure.
I mean, you guys remember the Horizon arriving at Pluto and what a big stir that caused with the first really awesome images of Pluto. Mm. Well, imagine that, but for Saturn. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune.
Wow.
You know, like all four of them. And Kara, how does this relate to our word? What's the word from last week?
Syzygy?
Oh, syzygy? Yeah.
Syzygy.
Oh, yeah. I guess they had to all be in syzygy for it to be able to fly by all of them. Or at least within some degree of syzygy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They were all on the same side of the sun. Mm-hmm. And that was a big deal. And NASA was like, this is a golden opportunity. We could send spacecraft to zip all of these planets because they all are in a line.
And that was one of the many things I learned about through watching the documentary. I never got a good sense of that when I was a boy. I was probably too young to maybe appreciate it, and it sort of passed me by without, you know, me taking a second look at it. But they brought that up specifically again, definitely. It only happens once every 176 years in alignment, which makes it possible for one of the Voyager crafts to rendezvous with all four planets. And they had to impress upon this to President Nixon at the time, who had to approve the funding in the early 1970s to get this off the ground. They sort of had to go in and make a whole pitch to him explaining the significance and how this was, you know, really for them, you know, once in a lifetime opportunity to do it. And they went back and forth a little bit. Long story short, Nixon decided to go ahead and approve it, but because of budget constraints or whatever, you had to design the craft to just go to Jupiter and Saturn. To design these craft to go to Uranus and Neptune would be an added expense, so they approved enough money to get you to the first two outer planets. However, quietly, the Voyager design team went ahead and built Voyager 2 for the four-planet rendezvous anyways.
Wow.
So they squeezed more money out of it. They got it to work somehow, and they said, forget that. You know, thank you, but we're going to build this thing to go the distance. Here's something else I learned. Frank Drake of the famous Drake equation, the one that expresses the mathematical probability of an advanced alien intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. It was Frank Drake's idea to put a record on the Voyager spacecrafts.
Oh, really?
So what it was,
wow.
what was originally proposed was a plaque like on the Pioneer missions, the one with that famous, you know, naked couple on there in the position of where the Earth is. It's sort of a famous, and it was controversial at the time because you had naked people on the plaque. So, instead, Frank Drake said, if you put a record on there, you can put much, much more data on there. You can put music on there, pictures on there, data about the equipment and everything else. And you coat it in gold to help preserve it through the ravages of the solar system and outer solar system and interstellar space, certainly. So, Bob, and they were starting to think ahead, plan ahead for when the craft were eventually going to be leaving.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
Why did I think that was Carl Sagan's input?
Well, he had input onto what went on the record.
Gotcha. Yep. But he didn't decide. Right. But it was actually Frank Drake who just. Did you guys know that Frank Drake, his daughter, Nadia Drake, is a really prolific science reporter and she writes a lot for National Geographic?
No, I did not know
that. Yeah, she's a really good science writer. Yeah, I follow a lot of her work. It's cool to see those relationships continue.
Well, families, sure. Exactly. Yeah, it passed down through the generations. And certainly Frank Drake, you know. I mean,
very cool.
One of the big names.
Well, yeah. Carl had them turn it around and take a picture of the Earth from.
Yes. They definitely talked about that in the documentary as well, how he went and pleaded with the NASA and JPL directors to do this. And initially they weren't going to do it. They said, what's the scientific value in this? And he said, no, you don't understand. It's the science communication value in this. And boy, was Carl right. I mean, he was so ahead, forward thinking in that respect. Part of his genius, just a small part of his genius. And they do talk about that later in the latter part of the documentary.
Yeah, that's the pale blue dot. Poetic. Yeah.
That's right. The Earth as a mote of dust,
suspended in
floating
a sunbeam.
Sunbeam. That's right. Yeah. That's right. So iconic to say the least. Oh, for the album, they talked about how long they had to produce the album and get it all ready to go. How long do you think they had? Time?
A month.
An afternoon.
Yeah. 6 weeks.
Whoa. And they got recordings from all over the world.
Yeah, they did. They did. And they had to select exactly what was going to go on there.
Did they commission them, or did they pull them from the Library of Congress or something?
No, they pulled them. They pulled them from libraries all over the place. Yeah. It was a big mission to get it all. But it obviously all did happen. Now, did you know that each of the launches, so Voyager 2 was launched first, each of them had problems at launch? So V2's launch happened, and they explain about how inside the capsule during the first stage of it being propelled into space, the machine was going crazy. It was being tossed and turned around in ways it just was never designed really to do. So what happened was, when it was finally released from its capsule and started its main voyage, It was showing all sorts of failure lights, and things were switching on and off, bizarre readouts, glitches, errors all over the place. They thought they were definitely going to lose this craft. But the computer team said, no, it's working things out. Let it do its thing. For there was a time of a lot of tension there. And the media apparently caught word that there was problems with Voyager 2. And you'll like this. So some of the media was speculating that Voyager 2 might be doing things against its programming. And one newspaper headline reads, "Is Voyager going HAL?"
Oh, my God.
Which is a reference to say, is the computer, you know, doing its own, you know, starting to do its own thing against its initial programming. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
That's
at the
time. Reference to 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. But it worked itself out, and even though it was nervous times. Now, when Voyager 1 launched, they talked about a problem with a leak in the propellant line. The first stage of the thrust was compromised. They weren't 100% sure that the second stage accelerator was going to have enough thrust to get V1 into its right trajectory. They really thought it was not going to make it, and it barely made it. Voyager 1 almost never made it to Jupiter because of that. But it did. It got there in the nick, you know, it just had enough thrust.
So, Evan,
barely.
Do you ever think about how are the aliens that find it going to play the record?
Well, there are instructions, and it also is a stylus or a needle, per se. All the tools are there for them to play the record, assuming that they can get the interpretation of the correct instructions in order to do it properly. But supposedly, it's all there, ready to go.
Yeah, good luck, because I've tried to, throughout the years of my life, tried to follow instructions that were written by a fellow human. But could you imagine trying to follow, like, instruct? I mean, Who makes the best instructions? Do you think IKEA has really easy, simple instructions or no?
Because it's all pictures?
I think that they're helpful because they're in pictures, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's...
The best instructions are YouTube, I think, bar none.
Because you're watching a video.
People are documentary, right, have already done it, and then they go ahead and record what they've done. So it's, you know, I don't think anything beats YouTube. I go there all the time.
Yeah, but I think that IKEA's instructions translate beyond language, which is nice. Yeah. You know, like YouTube's only helpful because they're in English. If they weren't, we'd be like, if we're watching Japanese YouTube, that would not be helpful.
Yeah, right?
We get seizures and stuff trying to watch it, probably.
Now, on a future probe like similar to Voyager, they could easily include just like a monitor, like an LCD monitor behind like a shield that you push the button or the manual crank or something. You open it up and then it plays. It could have hours and hours and hours of digital video and audio.
Oh, Steve, know? I mean, think about how much data could you put into a hard drive the size of, say...
Yeah, they could easily have terabytes of data.
Yeah, right? They could put every song, you know, every modern, whatever, every song from the last 100 years, you know, or 50 years or whatever, like easily.
Archive.org, just load that whole thing up there and you're pretty much good to go. I want to just bring up two other very quick things because I learned so much more about Voyager than in watching this documentary. And I took specific notes about things I didn't know before. So here's two quick things, guys. The Uranus Close Approach by Voyager 2 was January 24th, 1986.
3 years after I was born.
3 years after you were born and 2 days before Challenger space shuttle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So they were going to – and it's – I totally forgot about this. Or if I – you know, I may not have even known. I really don't remember. They were supposed to have a huge press conference that day in order to talk about Neptune, its large moons, and the wacky magnetic poles of Uranus. And the press all left the room basically to go cover Challenger stuff. So, like, there was no press there in the end to cover it, obviously.
Preempted.
So
yeah, that's sad.
And then the final thing about the disc, I learned the disc is designed to last in space a billion years. Gold disc. It was 1 billion years it should survive. And it's also encased in another gold plated case, and that's supposed to last 2 billion years. So they've planned on 3 billion years of survival.
That's awesome.
For this data.
3 billion years of cosmic
rays. 3 billion years. That's right. Yeah. That's right. And it is the final mission of Voyager because, you know, obviously its power supply and everything will be long dead, long, long, long dead after that. But the record will continue.
The problem is they would have to somehow.
The mission.
Somebody would have to actually get, like, catch it instead of it just being space junk that blows a hole in their hull.
Well.
You know what I mean? Like, at a certain point, it's just hurtling through space really fast.
Look, space junk, fire. Boom.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what happened in a Star Trek movie. One of the, a Klingon warship just blew it up. It's like,
Oh, no.
So catch the farthest if you can. Well worth the 2 hours.
All right, Jay, we're going to go from outer space to under the ocean, sort of. Well, back in time.
In the news,
there used to be under the ocean.
There is a, you ever hear of the ichthyosaur?
Yeah. Sure.
Yes.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
So that, it's really funny that the name actually translates to fish lizard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It sure does.
So this is an animal from the Triassic to the late Triassic to early Jurassic period. And this is this fossil, or one of the fossils, was found in Europe. But these fossils were discovered in Europe and Asia.
So it was a liminal creature?
I would think so.
Yay!
What you did there.
They lived about 200 million years ago, and they swam the world's oceans during a time when dinosaurs walked on all fours on land.
Or twos.
Or twos. That's right.
Twos. Sometimes threes if one of their legs was gone.
So,
tripod dino.
Very odd circumstance, but I'm sure it happened. So this guy hit the news recently because even though this particular fossil was found over 20 years ago on the coast of England, the fossil wasn't studied until recently. It turns out that she is the largest marine reptile of her kind on record, coming in over 3 meters long. And there's a cool story behind how this was figured out.
When you say of her kind, you mean of the ichthyosaurs.
Yes. Right. Of all
all right.
Existing fossils that we have, she's the largest. So The reason that no one made a big deal out of the original discovery of the specimen is because the first complete fossil was found a long time ago in 1810 by a paleontologist named Mary Anning.
Yes, and yep. I covered mm-hmm. her.
You did, and Mary unearthed her on the cliffs of Britain. And by the 19th...
She was very young, right?
Yeah, they said that she was a feisty paleontologist. So I don't know.
I know a few of those. Yeah. I know a few feisty paleontologists.
She did sound like a lot of fun, and I think it's just very cool that in 1810 a woman found this fossil. You know, that's fantastic.
And Jay, unfortunately, feisty for a woman in 1810 pretty much means once in a while saying, "Oh yeah."
Yeah, you're right.
I know. Yeah, that was probably their nice way to say that she was a bitch.
Yeah.
Because that's probably what the news reporter said.
Yeah, because, you know, a woman can't be intelligent back in 1810. No. I know, right? It's ridiculous.
She would have to also be hysterical.
Yeah. Oh,
that's right. That's right. Yes.
So in the 1990s, when they found the fossil that I'm talking about in this news item, it didn't make any big news because no one thought that there was anything novel about this particular one. And, they, you know, we've already known about them. But what's cool about the story is that a paleontologist named Sven Sachs was visiting the Lower Saxony State Museum in Hanover, Germany. And he saw the fossil on display and thought it should be studied closer. So he contacts this UK paleontologist named Dean Lomax. And Dean happens to be an expert on ichthyosaurs. And when Lomax took a closer look, he found a few very interesting things. One, first, it was an adult female and it was pregnant when it died. And it has a fossilized embryo inside of it. Second, he measured it and he found out it's the largest one that humans have found. And finally, he found out that its tail had been added from another ichthyosaur. And the reason was to make it look cooler. They wanted to make it look cooler in the museum on its display. Mm. And I didn't like that. I didn't like reading about that because I'm like, hey, guys, you know, don't take liberties with things like this because you're screwing up.
Piltdown man situation.
Right, yeah, you're screwing up. Yeah. You're screwing.
But you could see it when you look at the fossil. You could see how the tail is tacked on.
So this was...
Scotch tape.
This was... very interesting, and I would dare add exciting to think that a fossil that was already found, you know, over 20 years ago, was sitting in a museum, they pay closer attention to it and they find more information and new information, and it happens to be this, the biggest one in the world, and no one knew about it, just sitting on a wall somewhere. So, you know, I guess another interesting point is that there's a lot of unresearched material in the world's museums. That they're valuable enough to keep and to preserve and store, but there aren't enough scientists to do a deep dive on every single artifact that they find. And you never know. There could be a lot of other secrets sitting in a museum right near you.
Oh, always. Yeah. If you think about the collections are the coolest part of any museum. And usually you have to get special permission to go back and look at the collections. But for every, you know, one or two fossils that are out on display, there are like thousands of fossils in the collections in the back of the museum. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just about amassing as many as possible so that you can compare them. Obviously with like large organisms like ichthyosaurs, they're not going to have as many. But like if you've ever just looked at a museum's collection of trilobites or of what are the nautilus ones called? Ammonites. Thousands. Like most museums have massive collections because those are pretty easy to come by. And, you know, they like to compare and contrast the size and the shape and everything to learn more about it. But there are probably so many unstudied or poorly studied examples of different organisms in a drawer somewhere just waiting for a new student to get excited and to dive in.
Or someone to see it, you know, on display somewhere and say, hey, you know, what's special about that? There's something to that.
That's true.
And I have to point out that Ichthyosaurus is a genus. It's not a species, right? It's the genus Ichthyosaurus. Mm-hmm. This particular specimen is an Ichthyosaurus somersetensis because the first one of it was discovered in Somerset County in southwest England.
Oh, that's interesting. And also, yeah. I feel like sometimes taxonomy with dinosaurs is still sort of wiggly because there's no way to do genetic testing. So a lot of the way that we identify whether something is a specific species or a lot of times they're just identified as the genus, right? Because they don't know. They're like, is it a juvenile? Is it an adult? I don't know if these are different species. But it's based on the way we used to do taxonomy with like extant species. Like what do its hips look like? How do its bones connect? Because, I mean, now we know taxonomy way better because we can look at the DNA inside of an organism.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, just so, like to say, imagine a million years from now, a paleontologist looking at all of the various breeds of dog.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're the same species.
Yeah, but they would probably not think so if they didn't have the appropriate tools. But they
probably wouldn't. Yeah. By bones, not so much. By genetics, they're the same species. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point you made, Steve, because imagine if they only found the bones
Chihuahua and a St. Bernard.
Yeah, or of one quote-unquote dog. But think about how many different kinds of dogs there are and how that doesn't really represent. You know, it's not enough information.
Okay, Bob, how do magnets work?
Well, that's not actually what the news item was about, but nice try, Steve. So scientists and engineers have created the strongest resistive magnet in the world, and it's cool. You want more? Well, this new magnet was developed by at Florida State University in the U.S., and it's a whopping 41.4 Tesla, beating the old record by about 8%, which is actually which is actually a big leap in magnet technology. That's not trivial. So have you guys heard about resistive magnets? That's actually a little bit more obscure when it comes to magnets.
Those ones athletes tape to themselves?
it's pretty simple, though. You basically have either a permanent magnet, like a fridge magnet, or you have – and electromagnets, which has electricity passing through coils of wire. And there's essentially a couple types of these electromagnets. One is superconducting, which is kind of self-explanatory. And then the other one is resistive. It's made out of normal metal. But that actually doesn't do it justice. This one, for example, that I'm talking about, was formed from stacks of copper conductors and insulating material, which is put together in this helical structure. And this helical patterns is what creates a strong magnetic field in the center. It's in the center of the helix. And this wasn't trivial. You think, oh, you know, we know how to make electromagnets. Let's just slap this together. But it was not a walk in the park. This thing took 2.5 years to build, and it cost $3.5 million, United States dollars, of course, for the funding.
Where is it?
This was in Florida. This is at the,
Florida the Mag
University
Lab.
Of, yes, actually. Yes,
I've
the
been
Mag
there.
Lab. Oh, of course you have,
it's
Kara.
Crazy.
Of course you have.
Yeah. It's the, what is it? The National High Magnetic Field Laboratory.
It's an amazing place.
Oh, it's so cool.
Now, if you're fuzzy about the whole Tesla thing, I'm not talking about that hip electric car that's in the news every damn day or that brilliant but wacky scientist from a century ago. No, it's a standard unit describing the strength of a magnetic field. So Earth's magnetic field is 0.00005 of a Tesla. So it's incredibly weak, although it's incredibly important. It's really almost not even there in a lot of ways. But it does protect us from nasty things. There's a common bar magnet, which is 0.01 of a Tesla. And then there's something that I played with this weekend. Neodymium-based rare earth magnets. I'm sure a lot of you have messed with them, but every time I do, I am mightily impressed. They could hurt you. They could actually hurt you. They are just so damn powerful. I'm just amazed at what they could do.
What do they look like? What are they? How do we know?
Well, the ones that I had were just these little discs, like 7 or 8 discs. They were fairly small, smaller than the diameter of a penny. But they are, you actually have to think, all right, I got to be careful because this thing will actually, you know, if it pinches your skin, 2 of them pinch your skin, it would really hurt. They are just incredibly strong. And they're so strong that you don't want to pull them apart perpendicularly. You have to slide them apart. You're not going to pull them apart. I mean, that's how strong they are. So these, the neodymium magnets are 1.25 Tesla. And they are impressively strong. So these are actually, so the resistive magnet I'm talking about here is 41.4. So far more powerful than even the powerful neodymiums. Yep.
Well, I was just wondering, like, where does an MRI fit in to this?
They're like 1.5 at the low end, 3. As would be a 3 Tesla would be a powerful clinical MRI magnet. There are ones that are more.
And that's at the level where, like, if you're wearing jewelry in your face, like, it could rip it out of your face.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Like, not go into that room with anything that is ferromagnetic.
Yeah. Oh, geez. I just had an MRI. They ask you all sorts of questions. Were you ever hit with a BB when you were a kid? Could you possibly have metal under your skin, you know? And I'm like, unless I was abducted, I'm pretty sure I don't have any
were
metal.
Were you ever
an
arc welder? Yeah.
Right?
It was scary almost. I was like,
well, you know what happens? Let's say you've left a pen in your pocket and you walk into that room and it flies out and attaches to the magnet. They have to turn it off to get the pen off. Or
sure.
And then it takes like an hour to spark it back up. You lose like an hour and a half of
wow.
MRI time.
It's not just a quick
and those
switch.
Are expensive. Yeah, there's like techs who are working them. I've had to do a lot of fMRIs for TV, and you know, I always have to go through the motions of like taking out my lip ring and taking out all my earrings. But we're talking 40, you said 41.4
right.
Teslas. 40,
right. So this is it's powerful. This is powerful. They actually they codenamed the project Project 11, which is after the phrase "turn it up to 11," which is from what movie?
Spinal Tap.
Yeah, attaboy, attaboy. So lab director Greg Bobinger said, with the Project 11 magnet, we asked our engineers to turn it up a notch and see what they could accomplish, which I found very funny because it sounds like the engineer's dream, doesn't it? You know, and don't forget, these are cutting edge magnet engineers. So it's like, hey guys, here's $3.5 million. Let's see what you can do with it. So I'm sure they had a blast putting this together and they really did it. I mean, it could have lots of advantages in science down the road once this becomes a, you know, maybe even more common or even if it doesn't, they could, you know, they could use it for things like medical research, chemical reactions, even for quantum computing. It has so many applications. And of course, there's still some people, especially the local residents around this facility, that were actually afraid that the new magnet would affect weather patterns, which is pretty silly. Actually, you couldn't even detect the magnet even if you were just outside the building. So it's not going to – it's just so weird to think you would – somehow link strong magnets to weather patterns. Really? That's where you're going with this. So that's the story. But if you're like me, you're probably thinking, well, that's cool. But what has even more Teslas? Do you want to find, find out what has even more Teslas?
Magnetar.
Would have to be something.
Oh,
yeah,
shut up,
Evan.
I'm not there yet.
Okay, sorry.
All right, how about Earthbound? How about Earthbound?
Jumped ahead.
There's a hybrid. Okay. There's a hybrid magnet, which is actually a combination.
It's a hybrid.
Kentucky bluegrass.
Yeah. So it's a combination of a resistive and a superconducting magnet, and that can get up to 45 Teslas, which is, you know, a little bit more powerful, but still more powerful. But if you want the strongest man-made magnet, you need to go to a pulse magnet. That's the way to go. So for example, the Los Alamos National Laboratory has one that will go up to, wait for it, 100 Tesla. 100 Tesla. It is the highest non-destructive field in the world.
What do you mean by non-destructive?
I will tell you because it is awesome. I say this because magnets that are stronger than this have actually been turned on. I don't know how many Tesla, but stronger than 100, and they exploded. The magnet exploded because they couldn't handle the forces generated by that magnetic field. So it
did they explode or implode?
Exploded. They said exploded. Oh, okay. So the one in Los Alamos is the only one at that rate at 100 or higher that has been turned on and not exploded, which I think
is awesome. So it's non self-destructive because it's really destructive, right?
Right. The highest, yes, the highest. Yeah, they described it as the highest non-destructive. Yes, not self-destructive. So if you want to go higher, then yeah, you call it the magnetar. That's pretty much, you know, the most intense magnetic field, you know, localized. Yeah. I mean, you could have galaxies, you know, a galaxy that has these huge magnetic fields. But in terms of like localized intense magnetic field, you're not going to do any better than a magnetar. So remember, we're talking about the mass of a sun in a few kilometers. It's essentially a hypermagnetized neutron star. That's what a magnetar is. So we're talking 100 trillion Tesla.
What?
Yeah. 100 trillion Tesla.
That'll rip the fillings
right.
out of you,
Bob. How? If you didn't have any metal on you, how close could you get? Would that be what would it do to you? Could it do anything?
I will tell you, Jay.
10 light years.
This is what it would do.
Something.
You could actually feel the effects on our atmosphere of a magnetar, a star quake on a magnetar from light years away. They actually detected a tiny detectable ripple in our atmosphere from such a thing. So it happened because of a star quake, which kind of screws with the magnetic fields and releases all this radiation. So it's a rare and intense thing. But just a flat out, just a magnetar, baseline magnetar, this is what it would do to you, Jay, from thousands of miles away. Thousands of miles away. This is what an astrophysicist who studies these stars, this is what he said. He said that it would rip the electrons off of all the molecules in your body. You'd be literally atomized. Then you'd be ionized. Then you would turn into a cloud of plasma that would be accelerated to almost the speed of light.
That's how I want to die.
That's what he said.
That is so how I want to die.
Would I still be conscious?
for picoseconds. So that's what this one guy said. And wow, I mean, yeah, it would thousands of miles away. This is what it would do to you. Amazing. Oh, so, yeah.
All right, well, I'll put that on my list of shit to stay away from in outer space. Yes.
Places not to go.
Luckily, magnetars have a limited lifespan in terms of the lifespan of a neutron star. I think it's they degenerate over time, and they're not as intense. They're not really magnetars anymore. So I think they last for on the scale of thousands of years at that high intensity. So they're not easy to find. I mean, they actually are easy to find because they release a tremendous amount of detectable radiation like X-rays. So it's hard to have one that's hiding from us. But just be happy that there's none that are really close because, yeah, that would be nasty.
Why do they call it a magnetar? Why don't they just call it a magnetostar?
I know. I don't know.
Magnetar sounds like a weird – like a –
sounds like pulsar.
Magnetar.
Yeah,
right.
But yeah. Magnetar makes me think of like quasar. What are they called? Like a scimitar. Is that a
centaur?
Centaur is a sword.
Centaur is a mythical
beast.
Yeah,
and what's the other mythical beast that's like the opposite of a centaur?
Minotaur.
Yeah.
Minotaur.
That's what it sounds like. Magnetar sounds like one of those to me.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why it's cool.
Jason and the Golden Fleece.
Cool. Exactly.
All right, thanks, Bob. So, guys, there's a new survey out looking at food literacy. It's called the Food Literacy and Engagement Poll from Michigan State University, looking at attitudes towards genetically modified organisms.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. It's pretty much what you would think. So it's interesting because, again, this is the topic about which public opinion and scientific opinion are most divergent. There is a 51-point gap between what members of the American Academy of Science think about the safety of genetically modified food and what the general public does. There have been other surveys that have shown lots of interesting things as well, like the fact that 41% of people surveyed believe that eating a GMO tomato will change your genes.
Uh-huh.
This is looking at more general attitudes, not necessarily scientific literacy about GMOs, but this is the interesting bit that I found in the middle of this survey. So 37% of respondents thought that the following statement is true. Genetically modified foods have genes and non-genetically modified foods do not, 37%. But that was 43% for respondents who were 30 years old or less and 26% for respondents who were 55 years and older. So it was much higher percentage in younger people.
Oh, geez.
That means the future is dark.
It also means, unless, like, what are they learning in college?
Yeah, unless they learn as they get older, but
true. Yeah.
That's a modifiable figure there.
So they've been effectively scared is what it sounds like.
Yeah. Yes. That means propaganda
works. That's what it means. It means propaganda works. But this, I think, makes even more sense when you combine it with this other statistic. In the same survey, 46% of those less than 30 said that they purchase organic food whenever they can, basically. And only 15% of people 55 years and older said that they did. So those two numbers are remarkably similar. The 43% think that only genetically modified food have genes and 46% buy organic food in that same age group. And those numbers both go down significantly in the 55 years and older group. So you got to wonder if there's any kind of correlation there. Or what the causal connection might be, if there is one. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think those two things are related. And of course, a lot of the anti-GMO propaganda comes from the organic lobby. So it makes sense that people would have anti-GMO attitudes, misinformation about GMOs, and be sort of pro-organic, food, that those things would cluster together.
Yeah.
Very disappointed that those numbers are still so high.
You know what I think is interesting? I just clicked through to the article. I'm giving a talk on GMOs in about a month, I think, maybe even a little less, in Idaho, like for ag students. So they're all kind of on the we know what GMOs are and we are not afraid of them side of the spectrum. So this is like super good information. This is just published. One thing that I found interesting but not surprising was this one where it said, using a 1 to 5 scale where 1 is much lower than an average person and 5 is much higher than an average person, how would you rank your understanding of the global food system? And 38% said higher than average, when only 14% said lower, which I'm assuming means everybody else was on average?
Yeah, everyone else is average. But yeah, there's an asymmetry there, but more people think they're above average than below average, which should be the same. Should be the same. Yeah, but that's the overconfidence effect. That's pretty universal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. But it's like, it just goes to show like how much even more fueled they are when your head is full of propaganda. And then you're like, gosh, I know so much. I read all these Facebook posts.
Right. Well, that's why, so this gets to the Dunning-Kruger effect. Remember, Dunning, in a follow-up paper, wrote this quote, which I think is very, very correct. He said, "An ignorant mind is precisely not a spotless empty vessel, but one that's filled with the clutter of irrelevant or misleading life experiences, theories, facts, intuitions, strategies, algorithms, heuristics, metaphors, and hunches that regrettably have the look and feel of useful and accurate knowledge."
Oh, nice. So,
the people who are quote unquote ignorant, you know, especially I think in the modern culture of information, which includes a lot of misinformation, it's not that people don't have information, it's that they are full of misinformation. And the thing I would add to his list, it's not just, so he's correct, I think, that if you just go through your life passively gathering information, then you're basically at the mercy of your heuristics, you know, of the way your brain collates and makes sense of information, which is deeply flawed in a lot of ways. But we're not just passively drifting through information. There are people who are curating information, packaging it, building it into a nice, compelling narrative, and handing it to us. And if that happens to push our pre-existing emotional or ideological buttons, we gobble it up, right? And that feels like, wow, I'm so well informed. I know more than the sheeple. I know I have all these facts. And it gives the powerful illusion of being well informed, even when you have no idea what you're talking about. And what you think you do know is all mostly or entirely wrong. And of course, anybody could fall into that on any topic. Again, it's not like those dumb people are falling for this, but we don't. It's like, this is something that that can happen to anybody depending on the topic, right? And you may be in the mainstream and go along with the scientific consensus on one topic. Like maybe you think, the scientists say the planet's warming, so of course I accept the science of global warming, but those GMOs are poison, you know, or those vaccines will kill you. So, you know, people do sort of pick and choose their ideological topics. And
it does happen to everybody. It's just a matter of how much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. We're all constantly working on our own blind spots.
Yeah. And narratives. I think narratives, that concept of that we tell ourselves stories, the culture tells us stories, and those stories resonate with us. Those that do resonate with us, we accept. And then once you accept a narrative, the thing is, we are very good at then curating information to support that narrative. And then we also are very good at dismissing information, which calls it into question. So when you say, but the scientific consensus is that GMOs are safe, people say, but those are all funded by Monsanto. It's like, well, no, actually they're not. They're mostly independent. But those studies aren't long term. Well, actually there was a 19-year feeding study. But that was just one study, or that just only looking at animals or whatever. I mean, you could find endless reasons to dismiss the evidence that shows that GMOs are safe. Or then you appeal to the unknown. But we never really know. How could we possibly know that there isn't any long-term adverse effect? So then you move the goalposts, right? Totally out of view. And then if you deal with all of those issues, you basically address every possible denialist strategy about the safety of GMOs. Then people go, well, that safety is not the real reason I oppose GMOs. It's really because of I don't like to patent life. It's like, okay, but what about all the hybrid seeds that are patented? And they say, well, GMOs are, you know, then they kind of do this dance. It's like, well, yeah, but Monsanto specifically, I don't like their practices. Like, well, how are they different than any other corporation, really? But they're just a never ending tale. So, but what are we doing to the environment? Actually, these are better for the environment than using even more poisonous chemicals.
Yeah, it's true. And I I think I've mentioned it on the show before, but if you guys haven't watched Food Evolution, I highly recommend it. I think it's in theaters right now, and you know, we'll probably be on Netflix eventually, but definitely try and look it up, try and check it out, because it's like the only real doc I have seen so far on GMOs, other than things that were done on YouTube and really good science communication efforts like from different news organizations, but it's the only sort of theatrical documentary that I've seen that's got really strong science in it.
Yeah. Anyway, and people do change their minds. I'm not saying people don't. You know, a lot of people email us and said, oh, I was anti-GMO or anti-vaccine or whatever until I listened to your show. Mm-hmm. And then, we at least force people to reconsider their position, to think about it a little bit more deeply, you know. And actually, Kara, you're going to talk about a similar item. This is at the other end of the political spectrum about the government and global warming.
So there's an article in Nature, but also a lot of other outlets, like even WAPO picked it up, where a scientist, it started with just one scientist. Her name is Jennifer Bowen, and she is at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. On Facebook, on August 24th, she posted a screenshot of an email. She's since taken it down, but a lot of people grabbed it and tweeted about it. And I'm just going to read you the first paragraph of the email, and you guys can tell me what you think. Hi, Jennifer. I'm writing regarding your recently approved ficus proposal, number blah, blah, blah. Quote, combining high-resolution organic matter characterization and microbial metaomics to assess the effects of nutrient loading in salt marsh carbon sequestration. End paragraph, or end quote. So kind of this is a grant proposal. I've been asked to contact you to update the wording in your proposal abstract to remove words such as global warming or climate change. This is being asked as we have to meet the president's budget language restrictions and don't want to make any changes without your knowledge or consent. Below is the current wording for your abstract. At your next convenience, will you kindly revise the wording and send back to me as soon as you can? That way we can update our website. Please let us know if you have any questions about this request. Thank you. And that email apparently came from an official at the Department of Energy's Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, the PNNL, in Richland, Washington. Now, Nature tried to get a comment from the DOE, and they haven't been able to get one. And also, Bowen's lab kind of stopped responding, but WAPO has some really good quotes from Bowen. It also turns out that on August 23rd, the DOE's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California granted about 14 different projects. Actually, it's exactly 14. It's not about 14 from the Joint Genome Institute and the EMSL. And Jennifer Bowen was one of these 14 scientists that got a grant. There was another scientist named Jonathan Sanderman who worked on it as well, and he confirmed that email did come from the PNNL. There's also another scientist who got a grant, who Washington Post writes about, named Seleska. His name is Scott Seleska. He's an ecologist at the University of Arizona, and he said he received a similar letter from the same lab on his grant about studying permafrost and how permafrost is affected by decomposing plants. So what we're seeing right now is, and I want to be really clear because they really clarified this in their quotes to the WAPO, that they're only being asked to clarify the wording on their abstracts, that the projects are already funded and they haven't been threatened at all with funding being taken away. They also haven't been asked to change their projects. So these are individuals that are doing ecological research that's related to climate change, and they've not been asked not to do that research. They're actually being funded by the government to do that research. But what it seems like is happening is that they're being asked to finesse some of their language in such a way that maybe it doesn't raise any red flags. And so these scientists are, you know, understandably annoyed, yet in some ways it seems appreciative that individuals are working to make sure that the gears continue to churn and that they do what needs to be done to ensure that they can do that. Like, here's a quote from Bowen. I firmly believe that scientists should have the intellectual freedom to tackle the most pressing issues of the day, regardless of the political landscape. I also believe that researchers, policymakers, and the public should maintain an ongoing dialogue regarding the role that science plays in today's society. I think we all agree with that quote, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
But here is another quote. It says that she, quote, has immense respect for the civil servants who are doing a tremendous job facilitating our research under trying conditions. And so I think that the scientists who have posted these things in order to sort of draw people's attention to them also want to make sure that, as upsetting as it is, we know that they're not actually being asked not to do the research. But in a way, I mean, this is a form of government censorship. And so I think that that's the real concern right now. And it's probably so disconcerting that Bowen, if you try to look at the original post on Facebook, it's been taken down. I had to track it down on Twitter from somebody else who had retweeted it. And here is her response to the scientist or to the official that wrote her the email request. I understand that you are just doing your job, so I will refrain from comment. I redacted the offensive clause, revised abstract is below. Because the truth of the matter is they have to follow suit, right? She doesn't want to lose her grant funding and she doesn't want to not be able to do this research. So basically she just changed the word. Let me actually see if I can find it because it's highlighted in here. CO2 contributing to greenhouse gas release and climate change in unknown ways. She changed it to CO2 contributing to greenhouse gas release in unknown ways. So she just, the whole thing is about carbon and carbon sinks and sequestration and greenhouse gases. They specifically wanted to take out any reference to just the phrase climate change and global warming. But this is scary, right?
The president picking what language is okay on such an obvious and profound level, you would never think that we would be doing this type of thing in a modern society in the United States, right? I mean, how can that be happening?
Yeah, I mean, Seleska, who I mentioned, the other grant awardee, in this Nature article, basically, they say, Seleska says it appears that DOE program managers are trying to frame the work that they support so that it appears aligned with White House budget directives. What else can they do? He asks. He says he's more concerned that research priorities are being set by political ideology that's at odds with scientific knowledge. So, I mean, the frustrating thing isn't so much the having to change a couple of words in grant proposals. It's what it represents, right?
It's easy to see the next step, which is they're not going to fund studies which look at
climate change at all.
Yeah, climate change at all. Even if you scrub those words from your proposal, they're going to know, oh, this is about carbon sequestration. Nope, that's gone. We're not going to fund that. And it reminds me of, you know, there was a generation or more of textbooks in the United States that never mentioned the E word, no evolution. The word evolution was banned. They still spoke about evolution. They just didn't use the word, but it certainly caused confusion and watered down the treatment of the topic. And then, you know, basically raised a generation of kids in this country who didn't understand evolutionary theory.
Mm-hmm. And this isn't even like in stone yet, right? This is based upon what we've covered on the show before, the 2018 budget proposal for the Department of Energy Office of Science. Like, we've talked about the proposed cuts that Trump wants to scale back on, like NIH funding on a few different areas of climate research, for example, and some other areas as well. But the interesting thing is, even within the budget proposal, it emphasizes the need to study how carbon cycles through ecosystems. So there's this kind of confusion even at the top levels, and a lot of it does seem to be about framing. You know, it seems to be about making a political decision as opposed to a scientific one. Steve, you actually forwarded me an email or a story.
But let me give it a quick summary of that study that I sent you, though. So essentially, they wanted to study the grid system to prove that intermittent renewable sources of energy like wind and solar would break our grid, basically,
yeah,
because it was not on demand, it was intermittent. And what the study showed was that actually the grid system is fairly robust and that we can incorporate a lot of renewable energy sources into the existing grid without breaking it. And so it showed the opposite of what they were hoping to show, but they then changed the wording in the conclusions in order to spin it as negative as possible in the direction that they wanted. They couldn't change the actual data, so they just changed how it was interpreted, how they wrote about the interpretation. So they were imposing their political ideology onto this study to try to make it seem like it said what they wanted it to say in the first place. That's politics trumping science. That's horrible.
And it's probably going to be at least somewhat effective. That's the really scary thing, because as we know, often people read the introduction and they read the results. They read the conclusions. They don't read all the hard data in the middle. So if you're going to get this like 100-page, let's say you're a senator and you've got all these different reports laying across your desk that are hundreds and hundreds of pages, sure, hopefully you're having your aides read them and give you summaries. But when there's a summary included within that document, you may be quite likely to just read those summary pages and go, oh, this is what this report found? Okay. And not dig any deeper than that. And that's scary.
I'm blown away from it being this obvious and how damaging it really it is now and how horrible it can get. I mean, we're not even through year one yet of his presidency. And if he's going this hard against science, where
I agree, but I also want to just, and I know that I've been really conservative in talking about this, but the reason for that is that I want us to make sure that we're at least looking at the facts. There's no evidence that he told anybody to do this. There's no evidence that the people who did this didn't do it preemptively. Obviously, the environment in which these kinds of asks to scrub the references to climate change in their reports, the environment obviously was created and is being maintained. Yet that said, I do want to be very clear that like the Department of Energy did not comment. Who knows? They may be claiming that they never even sent the email. Like they've never owned up to the email being sent. And we have no idea how far up the chain this is being forced. It may be a preemptive kind of fear-based reaction, but either way, that's negative. That's not good.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it is what it is. I mean, you know, this is, I don't want to be afraid to say, look, something really wrong is happening. It's happening mm-hmm. right under our noses. It's part of the world we live in. And we just have to, you know, as adults, we have to own it and do the best that we can
yep.
to fight
against
it.
Yeah, and be aware of it. Yeah, keep our eyes open.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right, thanks, Kara. Jay, who's that noisy?
Noisy.
All right, let's get right into this. Last week, I played this noisy. Okay, so obviously, there's some familiar sounds in there. Notably what? What do you guys recognize right
well,
off the bat?
Train tracks.
And the yeah, Doppler effect.
Yeah. Doppler shift, sure. Yeah.
That clicking noise is the noise of train wheels hitting the spaces between the tracks. Just as a side note, I love that sound. That sound to me says a lot.
Soothing?
It's soothing, but it also has like an adventure element to it as well. You know, there's something like Murder on the Orient Express about it that I I want more. All right, we're hearing the train tracks noise, and now we're hearing a pitch change, and that pitch change is what I was focusing on. And we got a lot of emails in about this one. A lot of people had a lot of guesses. We had some very strange guesses. This guy said this week's noisy sounds like a train horn on helium. That was sent in by Roel Rupenthal. I never heard of a train horn on helium, but I thought that was funny. But we did get a couple of very close guesses, because that effect that you're hearing is indeed called the Doppler effect. And Kynan Utt was the first person to guess that part of it correctly. However, Ashley Norman nailed it, and she's the winner this week. Ashley said, this week's noisy is a reconstruction of a test done on the Doppler effect in 1842 by Christian Doppler. And in this reconstruction, the Hathorn Brass Band plays a G note out of the window of a train on the Great Central Railway line in the UK, with the noisy being the sound recorded at the Loughborough station as the train passed by, creating a sound begins. I know, right? The sound begins at just above G as the train approaches and falls to approximately an F sharp as the train travels away. So listen to it one
play
more
it again,
time.
Play it again.
I love that. That's so cool.
It is amazing. So the Doppler effect is it's a phenomenon that happens when an object is moving that's producing sound, and the faster it's moving, that movement can compress the sound wave and then extend the sound wave. So as it's coming close to you, it's compressing the sound wave, and as it's moving past you, the sound wave is getting stretched, and that's why you hear the note change from roughly a G to an F sharp.
Well, how about now, when it's right in front of you? Then it's not doing either.
Right. Yeah, it's when it goes past you.
Well, yeah, but as it's passing, yeah, it slides. It slides from
one to the other. Yeah, it's like when there's an ambulance that's like before you, your car, and then it reaches your car, and then it passes your car. Like, it's going through like a sliding scale. It's not like a perfect note.
Yeah. Right. And that's what I really noticed for the first time. It's not just like the before and after. It's also before, during, and then after.
This particular experiment, so special, is that you could hear the note start at G and very precisely go down to a lower note.
Yeah, it's cool. It's measurable, like with a tuning fork.
Exactly, right. We're seeing, and it's predictable. But moving on, I have a new noisy this week. This one is very, very cool. I think you're going to really like it. This week's noisy was sent in by a listener named Colbe Santana, and he gave me the pronunciation. Thank you, Colbe. This one's cool. I think you're going to love it. What do you think of that?
Oh my gosh. It's musical.
It is musical.
A theremin?
I'll tell you this.
A theremin, yeah. Everything's a theremin.
It sounds fluty.
It does have a flute-type resonance to it.
Yeah.
Guys, I can't wait to tell you what this is, particularly because of the people that I'm talking to right now. You're going to find this one fascinating.
Yay.
So, if you have a guess on this week's noisy, or if you heard something cool, and man, am I getting a lot of cool entries now, guys. You're really doing a great job. I love having a backup catalog of noisies, so just keep sending them in. Email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right, guys, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You got three regular news items this week. You guys ready?
Yes.
All right. Mm-hmm. Number one, a new study finds that eating a bland meal resulted in the release of greater endorphins in the brain than eating a delicious meal. That's a greater amount of endorphins. Number two, a new analysis finds that ancient Roman drinking water, despite the widespread use of lead pipes, was likely perfectly safe. And item number three, researchers find that 80-year-olds are as street savvy, able to determine how threatening someone is likely to be, as 18-year-olds.
Ugh.
An indication of disgust from Bob, which means that's Bob saying, pick me to go first.
Oh, man.
What, you think I was kidding?
I let my shields down just for a moment. All right, let's see. All right, a new study finds that eating a bland meal resulted in the release of greater endorphins in the brain. Huh. Why? That's bullshit. Why? I mean, I could kind of imagine, like, maybe your mind's like, well, this meal kind of sucks, but I'll make you feel good. But the brain doesn't do that. All right, let's go to number two. Ancient Roman drinking water, despite the widespread use of lead pipes. Yeah, you keep hearing that there's lead in there and that it was probably pretty bad, not very safe. But I could see, like, oh, they found some residue that would prevent the lead from leaching. Sure, that's totally possible. Whatever. So number three, let's see. All right, so you got the street smart 80-year-olds, just as savvy as 18-year-olds. I mean, but that's it, just street savvy is being defined here as how threatening someone is.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot more to being savvy than that, but okay, that's one.
That's why I included this, but the operational definition.
Yeah. So then if you're going to restrict that then to mean that, then that's better than just general street savviness. But okay, I can kind of buy that one. God, this first one's killing me though about the endorphins, because I could totally, it makes no sense, but I could totally see, oh yeah, by the way, blah, blah, blah. Screw it. I'll have to go with the endorphins fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Okay, yeah. Let's see. Endorphins. Right. Eating a bland meal. Is it trying to compensate for the lack of flavor? And it's somehow saying, hey, brain, this doesn't taste too good. You better release some endorphins to, you know, derive some more pleasure from eating this. I don't know. These ones that are subjective always seem to be a little squirrely to me. Next, the Roman drinking water, despite the widespread use of lead pipes, was perfectly safe. Okay, for a maybe a 35 or 40-year-old lifespan, yeah. I don't know how, you know, maybe 80 years might take more of a toll on someone, but people weren't living that long, I don't believe. So therefore, there's probably less chance of lead being a contaminant in your water, I think. And then 80-year-olds is street savvy. I suppose so. Yeah, I don't have any problem with that one. It's the one that has sort of the fudge factor as far as something that's a little subjective. So I think I go with Bob. I think it's the endorphins one is the fiction.
Okay, Kara.
I feel like you picked three news items this week that are all counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm.
So any of them could be the fiction. Eating a bland meal results in the release of greater endorphins than eating a delicious meal. Obviously, it seems more likely that if you ate, I don't know, a cinnamon roll, that you would have more endorphin release than if you ate, like, oatmeal. But maybe it's just the act of eating that releases endorphins. But then why would it be higher? I don't know. Okay. Ancient Roman drinking water, despite the widespread use of lead pipes, was likely perfectly safe. How is that the case? You can't, like, lead is not healthy. Ever. If it's leaching into your water. I mean, maybe they were also putting like oils and fats down the drains and they coated them. But again, like that is counterintuitive. And lastly, 80-year-olds are as street savvy as 18-year-olds. This one makes me think it might be science simply because it does have the operational definition of able to determine how threatening someone is likely to be. Because I think we all know that 80-year-olds are more likely to get taken advantage of. Like they're scammed more easily, the elderly. So in that sense, they're not as street savvy. I think there's science to back that up. But able to determine how threatening someone is likely to be, I think they might be more able to do that because they have more wisdom. I don't know. I'm going to say that one's science. So now it's between the bland meal and Roman drinking water. And I'm just having a hard time with the idea that lead pipes were safe. I bet you a bunch of Romans died of lead poisoning. So I'm going to say that one is the fiction.
And Jay.
I'm agreeing with Kara about the 80-year-olds. I would think that they would, as a baseline, probably have more information to draw on about if someone is a threat or not. So I think that one is at the very least science. The first one about the endorphins, I mean, yeah, Evan, maybe you're right about, you know, your brain might make up for the difference in the overall taste of the food. But it's funny because you think about eating something that you really love. And man, like I'm feeling a much more intense endorphin release when I'm making the yummy sound, right? If something is like really tasty,
right.
You know, you're not responding to bland food the same way emotionally that you do to really delicious food. But I could see there's something there. But I got to tell you something. This whole thing with the lead pipes, I can't imagine that all of the research is wrong. I mean, they can so easily test if lead is leaching into the water that passes through these old pipes. And there's a lot of those pipes still in play. I mean, I saw them when we went to Herculaneum in Italy when I was a kid. They still had plumbing in the streets. I mean, they had tiles that they lifted up. We could see the pipes that they had. So
that's so cool.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You know, the ancient world, there was a lot of pretty serious technology going on. And I can't believe this one is wrong. I can't, because lead, it is raw lead. You know, it's lead, and it's going to leach itself into the water when water, you know. Even in their goblets, you know, they would drink wine out of goblets, and the wine actually made the lead leach even more. So I believe that one is the fiction and the other two are science.
Okay, so an even split between one and two. So we'll start with the third one.
Uh-oh.
Researchers find that 80-year-olds are as street savvy, able to determine how threatening someone is likely to be, as 18-year-olds. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Oh.
Yeah. Whew.
Oh, I get one right at least.
Yeah, so far, so good.
Yet again, it's a 50-50 chance.
It always seems to boil down.
Yeah, so the researchers were looking at people's ability to tell, basically looking at a video of somebody like walking down the street. You know, is this guy going to jump you? Is this guy going to threaten you? Or is he any risk to you or whatever? And you could tell by the way people walk, like how aggressive they are. You know, there's a lot of nonverbal sort of visual cues that we use. And what they found is that our ability to size somebody up visually in terms of how aggressive or threatening they're likely to be, increases pretty significantly as we age, as from a child, but it peaks around 18 years old, you know, as a young adult. And then it pretty much stays the same throughout our lifespan. So even until we're 80.
Cool.
This is something that we learn as children, and then that's it. And we pretty much have it down for the rest of our life. But yeah, it doesn't degrade. They were actually wondering if it was going to be something that like older people would lose the ability to tell, but they really didn't. And that kind of makes sense. That kind of basic social knowledge kind of sticks with you. It's very automatic, very ingrained. Doesn't take a lot. You know, even that would be very resistant, I would think, to even like mild cognitive impairment.
Yeah, that would. But I think this one was a red flag because so much research shows that like gammers prey really heavily on elderly.
Yeah, but that takes a higher cognitive ability than just socially sizing somebody up by visual cues. Completely different cognitive ability. Yeah, it's not just this is not testing how naive they are. This is just testing again, just. You know, are you able to tell that I should walk on the other side of the street from this guy? Because it makes me wonder if they controlled for things like race, you know, and the age of the
person.
Would an 80-year-old be more scared of an 18-year-old than if another 18-year-old would be? I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
But if you control for those variables, I guess there was no difference. Okay, let's move on to number two. We'll go backwards. A new analysis finds that ancient Roman drinking water, despite the widespread use of lead pipes, was likely perfectly safe. Jay and Kara, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and Evan, you think this one is science. Let me tell you a little story about this. This is interesting.
All right.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, it's true that the Romans did make a lot of their water pipes out of lead, hence the word plumbing, right? Plum for lead. And that water will leach lead out of the pipes. And if the water's more acidic, it will leach it even more. That's what happened. Remember, what was the town?
Flint,
Michigan.
Yeah.
They changed the water source and to a not as good a water source because it was cheaper and that water was more acidic and it leached a lot of lead out of the old pipes, you know. And because it's alarming how many water systems in the U.S. still have really like 60, 70, 80-year-old lead pipes, you know.
Our infrastructure sucks.
Yeah, infrastructure really needs to be fixed. So, but here's the interesting thing. If there's a lot of lime in the water, then those pipes will calcify very quickly.
Oh, no.
And the layer of calcium will keep lead from leaching out of the pipe into the water.
Beautiful.
Jay.
And so, and
all right, so go on.
Why is he saying this beforehand? Shit.
Historians agree that the water that the Romans were using would probably have had a high lime content and that the pipes would calcify. And so they would only leach lead for a very short period of time after being installed or after being repaired. And then they wouldn't anymore because they would be basically coated with calcium.
But that amount of time was sufficient to poison a bunch of people?
No, actually wasn't.
Crap.
But a new study found antimony in the lead pipes as well.
What antimony?
Antimony.
Antimony? Wow, that's what she's been.
Or is that antimony? I heard no antimony. And that would leach out of the pipes. And that would actually be very toxic. So that
one
is the fiction, but not for the reason you thought. Yeah. So that was surprising. They were testing the pipes to see if they would have been poisoning themselves. And they're like, holy crap, look at all this antimony.
What's antimony?
It's another mineral and it's acutely toxic. So it would have not just been poisoning them over years, but if you got a high enough dose of it, you would get vomiting, diarrhea, dehydration. Long term, it could affect the liver and kidneys, even cause cardiac arrest. So it's interesting. You know, they may have been, you know, really poisoning themselves with the water from their lead pipes.
Wow, that's fascinating that they didn't like realize.
Yeah, that
I guess
the more
so many other things
stuff,
kill you.
The more acute stuff, you think they would have figured that out.
Yeah, but it's like, I mean, everybody's sick, right? You didn't live that long back then, right, so right.
That's what I said.
Yeah, because the water wasn't clean. It was just being delivered to their homes. But, like, it was probably still full of pathogens, don't you think?
I mean, they they were getting it from lots of different sources, but I don't think that the water itself was poisoning them.
Let's just end this crappy segment.
Living in any ancient time, yeah, you were, life was short, brutish, and nasty, right?
Oh.
Okay.
Dysentery.
Let's go on to number one. A new study finds that eating a bland meal resulted in the release of greater endorphins in the brain than eating a delicious meal. That one is science, and yes, it is counterintuitive, which is why I included it. The results were very surprising. So this is why the study was done. This is a PET scan, right? Positron emission tomography, looking at 10 healthy males eating various meals, one eating a nutrition drink, which is very bland. The other one was eating a pizza, which was believed to be a pleasurable, much far more pleasurable meal, which I agree. And the other one looking at their brain after fasting overnight as sort of a control. And they also asked them a number of questions, like how much do you enjoy this, you know? And of course, they enjoyed eating the pizza a lot more than the tasteless nutrition drink. But when they looked at the PET scanning, that after they drank the tasteless nutrition drink, they actually released more endorphins throughout the brain than after eating the pizza.
I don't believe it.
Weird.
Yeah, it's interesting. Of course, endorphins are endogenous opioids, so it's basically like your brain's own morphine. In fact, this is why opioids like morphine work, because we already have the receptors there for our endogenous endorphins. And so here's the reason this study was done. The question is, because we knew from previous studies that endorphins and opioid receptors were used as a signal for eating, but what we didn't really know is whether the endorphins were signaling pleasure, like the making, that's why eating is pleasurable, or if it was activating the satiety system, just making us feel full. And what this study suggests is that there really wasn't much of a relationship between, there was no relationship in the study between the intensity of the endorphin release and how much the subjects enjoyed the meal. Therefore, they think the endorphins are serving a purely satiety signal. It's just signaling that you're full, not signaling you're enjoying eating this meal, which is interesting. That was actually the specific question they had for the study, and that's what this suggests. But you would think endorphins, yeah, that's like part of the pleasure experience, but it really isn't. It's just telling you that you're full. But what is also interesting is that opioid receptors have a feature where they can be downregulated with repeated stimulation. You see where this is going? So if you habitually overeat, you downregulate your opioid receptors, which then means that you have a blunted satiety response to eating.
Uh-oh. So this leads to more eating.
This leads to more eating, mm-hmm. and that it could be associated with obesity.
Yeah.
That completely fits with my experience in that, you know, there are times like when I'm dieting or not dieting and when I'm eating a lot less, I'm a lot less hungry, you know? And then when eating more, it's like you can't get enough, you know? You guys have the same experience?
Sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah, you can get into, you know, I think it's not as simple as we're stating it here, but I definitely think that's a factor.
Yeah, right. Of course, it's more complicated. But yeah, I think it's a factor. But yeah, which is why I think it's a good idea, like if you want to sort of change your eating and lose weight, like just really forcing yourself to eat very little for a couple of weeks is probably a good way to kickstart it, because then it sort of resets your hunger a little bit, and then it becomes easier to moderate your eating. Not that you shouldn't fast or anything. There's also, there's actually just a study I saw today where they showed that people who lose weight slow and steady, like if you lose like a pound a week, but every week, like consistently, they are much more likely to keep the weight off after 2 years than people who have a lot of fluctuation. Yeah. So slow and steady is the way to go. Yeah. Not widely fluctuating one.
It's so not satisfying though.
Oh, no.
Well, good job, Jay and Kara.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'd be interested to know like what all the permutations of you four guys of who wins and who loses each week are. If there's any patterns, like do any two of you tend to go together?
Yeah. Or like who influences whom more?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I don't know. My really armchair sense is that Kara and I win a lot together.
Think so?
But I don't feel like I win a lot.
Could be confirmation bias.
Yeah.
I'm sure it is.
I think it also depends on the topic. Like, And Steve is obviously smart enough not to have Bob answer first on like a space one and
exactly.
not to have me answer first on a neuro one. And yeah. then we're like, oh, crap.
If I remember.
Yeah. yeah.
And if we're talking about Thanksgiving, I have to go last.
And dentistry.
and dentistry.
That's right.
Or pilgrim dentistry. Okay, Evan, give us a quote.
Bias is strong. It is in us, in our families, in our communities. It is in our institutions. It feels safe, but bias is very dangerous. It can not only skew the results of a test, it can undermine our conclusions and the policies we make based upon those conclusions. It is imperative that each one of us confront our own personal as well as institutional bias and prejudice and to excise them in any way that we can. And that is the wisdom of Adam Savage.
Adam.
Words spoken at the March for Science 2017. Yeah.
Didn't you dress up as him for Dragon Con last year?
I did. Yes, I did. and I might again this year.
You yeah. looked just like him.
Or actually, yeah. he looks like me, technically.
There you go. Yeah.
cool. Yeah, bias is the enemy. It takes a lot of work. You have to be very vigilant and work hard to weed it out because it just gets more subtle, you know? That when you
constantly.
Try to get rid of bias, you just make your own biases more subtle. And the ultimate bias is that you don't have any bias. That's like dreaming that you wake up, you know? You think you're awake, but you're actually still asleep.
I had that just the other night, in fact.
All right, well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You're quite welcome, sir.
See you at DragonCon.
Yeah, so this show will be going live while we're at DragonCon, and we'll see you guys all there in a few days. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.